I have just returned from a visit to the battlefields near Arras, and the oppression of it all is terrible, far more terrible than anything I had imagined. The desolation and the hideous loneliness of that great desert of ruins really defy description. These words were not written or spoken by me on a battlefield tour in 2026, but in October of 1919, less than a year after the armistice and the guns had fallen silent. And they were written by a journalist in a newspaper called The Graphic. I think it was published in a number of newspapers. And that journalist was called Helen McKee, and she was seeing the battlefields in all of their destruction, the Red Zone as it was called. We think about the Somme and Ypres, but Arras, of course, had suffered so much during the four long years of the Great War. Welcome to another episode of the podcast I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And it's that area around Arras that we're going to concentrate on once again today, and especially the area around Vimy Ridge and Roclincourt. As you listen to this and as I speak, 109 years ago, that Battle of Arras was about halfway through. There were still a few more weeks to go before the battle officially ended. The killing, of course, went on. It always does, regardless of when the historians say the battle ends. And this week I wanted to share with you this description by the journalist of what it was like on the Arras battlefield after the fighting had ended. We're also then going to hear an incredible story about a soldier who was reported dead and in fact buried when he was in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. We hear his story written by himself. And we also visit one or two of the cemeteries that I visited on the battlefields a few weeks ago on a battlefield tour. And I finish off the stories that I began to tell a few weeks ago in the podcast. So just going back to this account of Arras in October 1919, Helen McKee, the journalist, says, "I got to Arras after a long and tedious journey from Boulogne. My hotel, once a large and comfortable place, is now just about holding together. A shell once went completely through half of it, and oiled paper takes the place of the shattered glass in the windows, while holes in the wall are stuffed with sacking. All over the city, you hear the noise of the sawing and the hammering of wood, of the chipping of stones. Everyone everywhere is repairing, propping up and rebuilding Arras. I was going to the British cemetery at Roclincourt to see my brother's grave. On the way, we found the outskirts of Arras terrible. Every house is a ruin, and the road is ploughed up with shell holes, which have been finally turned into trenches. We met a great rumbling cart in charge of three jocks, who told us they'd just buried 37 bodies and were going back to carry more bodies to the little cemetery. At last we came to Roclincourt. It had once been a little village of 600 inhabitants. Today there is nothing, nothing but a few walls and torn stumps and trees. And there, just in front of us, in the midst of the trenches, dugouts, barbed wire, and all the debris of the battlefield, was the little cemetery with hundreds of wooden crosses, one half French and the other British. Overlooking it stood a great crucifix, and the figure of Christ riddled with bullets and shrapnel. And yet there was a feeling of beautiful peace about this poor little cemetery in the middle of that awful battlefield." Now, what she's describing there is the original cemetery, the battlefield cemetery at Roclincourt. Roclincourt was just behind the British lines on the 9th of April 1917, and the dead from the opening days and weeks of the battle were brought back to Roclincourt and buried there, including, as she says, her own brother. But the cemeteries wouldn't look like they do today. There'd have been wooden crosses. In the black and white photographs, they look dark, but I think most of them were white. And it was to be a few more years into the 1920s before what was then the Imperial War Graves Commission came along, replaced the wooden crosses, burnt most of them, returned them home if requested to do so by the family, and replaced them with the beautiful Portland headstones that we see today, and began the work of the horticulture, laying the grass, the building of the walls, the installation of the iron gates and the bronze memorial books. There was so much work to be done, and work that when Helen McKee visited had not yet begun. Now, the good news is I've managed to track down who her brother was. There are two cemeteries in the Rocklincore area, Rocklincore Military Cemetery and Rocklincore Valley Cemetery, that we're going to visit later on in the podcast. Well, it was quite easy to find her brother. A simple search on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website found that there's just one soldier called McKee that died on that day, and he was Second Lieutenant Douglas Hamlin McKee of the 3rd Battalion, but attached to the 27th Tyneside Irish of the Northumberland Fusiliers, and he was 24 years old when he died on the 11th of April 1917. And he came from Battersea Park in London. And on his headstone, the family inscription says this: "And how man can die better than facing fearful odds." It was French troops that held this area around Rocklincore before March 1916, and they built their own military cemetery here. And Helen mentions the French graves, but they're now long gone, moved to one of the French national cemeteries nearby. And then the cemetery that she saw was begun by the 51st Highland and the 34th Divisions in April of 1917. And there are many burials there from the 9th, the first day of the battle. And it was used as a frontline cemetery right up until October 1918. And then after the armistice, as with so many of these cemeteries in the area, there were many more brought in from smaller cemeteries north of Rocklincore. There's now 916 Commonwealth burials there from the First World War, and only 32 of them are unidentified, and there's also four German war graves. And it was designed by one of the famous Commonwealth War Graves Commission architects, Sir Reginald Blomfield, the man that designed the Menin Gate. And I found a website that tells us all about that man, Douglas McKee. And I'll put a link to this website so you can see the photos of him and also Helen herself. There's a wonderful photo of Douglas and his two sisters in childhood. I'll put that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. And the website tells us that Douglas' first taste of battle was during the Arras offensive. He was wounded in action and died from his injuries on the 11th of April 1917. He was born in Bayswater in London in 1893, and his two sisters were Helen and Catherine. And Douglas attended Streatham High School, and then he went to Tiffin Boys School. But in 1908, he left education and pursued a career in banking. He took a job at the British Law Fire Insurance, working for the father of one of his school friends. In 1910, he joined the London County and Westminster Bank as a junior clerk. And by March of 1914, he'd been given a job as a clerk working for the London and Brazilian Bank in Santos. So that meant that his life took him to Brazil in South America. He sailed from Southampton to Brazil on the 10th of April 1914, and he had a great life out there, living with a German family, ironically, and he fell in love with a Brazilian girl who was called Leah. And he also took part in sports and expeditions into the jungle. But he kept up a correspondence to his sisters back home, and even though he was so far away from the events that were developing in Europe, he noticed that out there French, German and British expats were returning home because of the war that they could see coming. He himself was sceptical that the conflict would be a long one, and as it became clear that the war was going on longer than he thought, Douglas's letters sought news of friends who had joined up to the fight. And in July 1915, he applied to his employer for leave to return to England and join the army. They granted permission for Douglas to do that. He said goodbye to his loved one, Leah, who he never saw again. And he arrived back in the UK in August of 1915, and he initially joined the Artist Rifles as a private. And then he was granted a commission as a second lieutenant with the Northumberland Fusiliers in May of 1916. He'd always wanted to be an officer. And he witnessed whilst training some of the Zeppelin raids on the city of Newcastle. And he became ill. And while recovering in hospital, he wrote to his family about his desire to go back to Brazil. And he also said that he wanted to join the Royal Flying Corps in order to fly himself back there. And he lost his taste for flight when he found out that a school friend had been killed in action whilst flying with the RFC in August of 1916. eventually recovered and he was dispatched to France in January of 1917. But as soon as he got to France, they found that he was still ill and he was deemed unfit for service. But it wasn't long before he was fit again and he was ready for the big push, the latest big push, the battle that we now call Arras. But he'd become demoralised by this time and he hadn't actually gone into battle. He knew this was going to be no walkover, no picnic. Everybody knew this by now from what had gone on in 1915 and 1916. On the 3rd of April, he wrote to his sister, reporting that he would reluctantly be going up to the front line in this attack. And he said to her, "Well, my one wish is to be back with the Blighty next week. There is absolutely nothing inviting about this part of France at any rate just now." And for those that don't know, a blighty is what the soldiers called a wound that was serious enough to get them out of the trenches, out of the front line and back home, but not serious enough to kill them or have life-changing injuries. He wrote again on the 8th of April. He said, "I've had my first baptism of fire. A 6-inch shell landed a few hundred yards from us yesterday. Our own guns are creating a tremendous row, but placed just beside our billet, rapidly taking our slate off the roof. My hair oil jumped about a foot from the table when it was firing this morning." And that same day, he moved up to the front line in advance of the attack. And still, the bombardment continued on the German lines. Douglas didn't go into action initially, but on the 11th of April, he was wounded in action. And he was dead by the time he reached an aid post. News of his death reached his family 2 days later on the 13th, and upon hearing it, his sister Helen, our correspondent, sought ways to piece together the circumstances of his death by writing to his friends and members of his regiment, but she didn't have much luck. But on the 20th of April, the family received a letter from his commander. It says, "I'm most distressed to have to write to you about the death of your gallant son. Though he was with us for so short time, he succeeded by his courage and splendid example during the attack in gaining the confidence of his men and the admiration of the officers over him." Similar letters I've read time and time again, and you wonder whether the writer actually knew him very well. Helen herself went on to have a very successful professional life. She collected Douglas's letters, photographs and documents. The war shaped her life. She worked for the Bystander magazine and The Graphic as an illustrator, and she drew lots of cartoons of soldiers. And the success of her wartime work eventually earned her an unusual commission. In 1931, she was invited to Germany by Adolf Hitler, no less, to draw him and his staff at the Brown House in Munich. She became the only woman to draw the future Führer in his headquarters. There's a large collection of her work in London now at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Can't imagine that. Not only did she meet Adolf Hitler, but she drew him. She was invited to do it by him. He must have heard of her. And that was in 1931, before he'd taken control of Germany. I wonder what she thought with what was to come, 10 years or so later, as Hitler destroyed Europe in the same way that her brother had died in 1917. There's a black and white, grainy photograph, and it shows Helen standing by the grave of her brother in Rocklincourt Military Cemetery. And as I mentioned, you can see that they are the original wooden crosses there. Her right hand is on it and her left hand is her notebook. And she's dressed very smartly. And she continues, if we go back now, to her writing that she wrote for that Graphic magazine. She says, "Just beyond lay the old German trenches, over which nearly all the brave men who lie in the cemetery had advanced in the April of 1917. Of course, her brother was one of them. Behind these, the battlefield seems more awful than ever. The trenches have been battered and pounded. The intervening space was a mass of shell holes. Everywhere were to be seen shell cases, shell tops, unexploded shells, bits of equipment, battered helmets, twisted masses of rusted barbed wire, and sometimes even bones, with here and there a lonely little cross, sometimes with a helmet or a water bottle or a bayonet tied to it, showing how every inch of the ground had been fought over and the frightful cost at which it had been won. Farther on are more trenches, more hideous debris, another British cemetery, the next day's casualties. And so it goes on. Wherever I went, I met with much kindness from the peasants. They are really wonderful. Although they've lost everything and suffered greatly, their spirit is quite unbroken. In many places, as far, for instance, as Monchy-le-Preux, they are actually still living in the cellars, waiting and working till their homes can be rebuilt, though they frankly admit that they dread the approaching winter owing to the great shortage of coal. The work of the Graves Registration Unit is wonderful. They're all very kind and ready to help me find the grave I looked for. All the battlefields are carefully searched for bodies which had not been buried properly. Whenever a body is found, a note is made for its removal. The bodies in all small cemeteries containing less than 50 graves are to be removed to the larger ones. On many of the battlefields, the work of clearing up proceeds. Now that the Germans have mostly all been repatriated, and that most of the Chinese too, picturesque groups of Algerians and French peasants can be seen at work. I wonder if Helen ever returned to Rocklincourt and saw her brother's grave with the Portland headstone there. What happened to her? She died in February 1957, but she went on to have much more success in artistic life. She designed murals for the Ritz Hotel, the famous Ritz Hotel in London, and also some murals for the first holiday camps that were established in the UK. Butlins, people will know. And also she worked for the Ford factory at Dagenham and the famous Selfridges shop in Oxford Street. She never married and she spent much of her time in later life with her younger sister. But what a legacy she's left to us. So for this next story, I recorded it live on the battlefield at Rocklincourt a few weeks ago. And it wasn't in the same cemetery that we just talked about, Rocklincourt Military Cemetery. It was just a mile or so away at Rocklincourt Valley Cemetery. And this is what we discovered when I visited there with a couple of other people that I was guiding. So we've come to one of those concentration cemeteries on the Battle of Arras battlefield in an area that was taken on that successful first day of the battle, the 9th of April 1917. And Rocklincourt Valley Cemetery, which is in a very shallow valley. This area that we're in was just within the British lines before the Battle of Arras. And it was here that the 51st Highland Division and the 34th Division advanced on the 9th of April. And the cemetery was originally called Rocklincourt Forward Cemetery No. 2, and it was begun shortly after the battle on the 9th of April 1917 by units which had fought on this day. And it was used until the following August. There were just 94 soldiers that were here up to that stage. And the cemetery was enlarged after the armistice, and nearly all of the 500 odd graves here date from April 1917, from those two attacking battalions that were brought in from the surrounding battlefields. And I can see on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, there are 5 cemeteries that were closed down. The burial was brought here. There's 83 unidentified casualties here in amongst the 548. 440 of them are British here, 22 South African, 2 New Zealanders, and just 1 Canadian. Now, I wanted to come here to see one soldier from Northampton that I was interested in finding. But then, when I was putting together the itinerary for this tour, I was contacted by a friend in Northampton, and he said that he was buying the memorial plaque, the death man's penny, to a soldier, and could I research him, please? And incredibly, that man that he was talking about is also buried here in Rocklincourt Valley Cemetery, a cemetery that previously I knew nothing about and had never been here. What a coincidence that 2 soldiers from my hometown would bring me here on this sunny spring day. Let's go and find Edward Bolton, shall we? Plot 2, F7.
E. Bolton.
Yeah, 14th of April 1916. Not 1917, this time, from the Cheshires. a private soldier. He was a regular soldier in the army before the war, and he came over as early as August 1914 in one of the BEF, the old Contemptibles. And he deserted after just 1 month with the... So although he was a regular soldier, he'd never seen anything quite like this. Yeah. You know, he'd have been on garrison duty somewhere. He'd never, he hadn't seen what he saw probably in those early months. Yeah. He was recaptured. He was tried for desertion on the 11th of August 1915, sentenced to death, and it was commuted to 10 years penal servitude, penal service, and that was suspended, of course. They wanted him back in the army. 3 months later, he was granted leave to return to England, but he didn't come back, and he was arrested at a place called Ince in Lancashire, where he'd been working, and changed his name to Cunningham to try and hide himself. So he was returned to France for his second trial. He disputed none of the evidence given against him, given on account of having originally enlisted in the name of Bolton because he'd been in trouble. His real name was actually Cunningham. And he said he was being treated with contempt in the regiment after his first desertion, and of some effort made to join another regiment when he'd been in England, he asked for another chance. Give me another chance, he said. But he was automatically sentenced to death, but it, you know, it went all the way up the line. And because he was a contemptible, old contemptible soldier, they thought, perhaps they thought he should have known better. And they've shot him at dawn, and here he lies. Private F.H. Pettit, Upper Harding Street, again within town of Northampton. And he's died on that day, on that 9th of April, as many of these have, in that initial advance, which has gone from here. This is the jumping off position.
Okay.
We're just behind, and so they've gone up. Gone uphill, there we've got hill, and they've gone in that direction. And he's one of those, one of the many who sacrificed their lives in the opening of the great advance on Easter Monday, was Private Francis Pettit of the Suffolks from Upper Harding Street. He actually younger than what he looks, he's 24 years old. He worked for Simon Collier and the boot manufacturers in Northampton. He enlisted in August 1915, he was a volunteer. A second son, Private Albert Pettit, he was, at that time when he died, he was in hospital suffering from gunshot wounds in the thigh. And he was in Western Fable Hospital, which is just up the road from us. It's now an old people's home. So hopefully he survived. But Pettit was one of those from the 11th Suffolks that died in action on that successful day. And then the other one that I knew nothing about until, as I say, my mate contacted me and said he was buying the penny, was in Plot 1. Plot 1, Row C. And his name was Biles. There you are, young man. This man's in the Royal Army Medical Corps. And but what my mate was really interested in was how he can be killed serving in the Royal Army Medical Corps. Well, I found out. This was several weeks into the battle. And they were, they'd got a field ambulance in this area, and he was one of the stretcher bearers that was going up to the dressing station and bringing them back. A shell came over and killed them. And the newspaper says he'd been serving for several months in France. Andrew Charles Biles came from Oliver Street and was killed innocently by a shell on May the 10th. 24 years old, enlisted in October 1915, been working for Sears & Co, another shoe factory. And there's a sign there that he was a Christian, because on his headstone, Soldier of Christ Arise. And he was a Sunday school teacher at St Matthew's Church, where we came across one of the bell ringers earlier on from that same church. His captain writes, he was a willing and unselfish worker, a cheerful, under most trying circumstances. Two brothers are serving with the yeomanry in France. And I wonder whether his religious beliefs took him to the Royal Army Medical Corps rather than the infantry.
Quite
similar to the conscientious object. There's no evidence for that, but it's just a thought. So this next story I stumbled upon, really, and it's almost beyond belief, but I would have wondered now, having thought about it, whether perhaps the circumstances that I'm going to describe in a minute happened more than once. But to set the scene for this, let's go again. It's the 9th of April 1917, the opening day of the Battle of Arras, and it's at Rocklincourt. And we've already seen that the two cemeteries that we've talked about were established by the 51st Highland Division to bury their dead after that successful first day. And serving within the 51st Highland Division was the 1st Machine Gun Corps. And their unit diary tells us what we already know, really, to start with, that 0 hours, 5:30 a.m. and there was continuous artillery barrage on the German trenches until 0 hour plus 5 hours. And the bombardment gradually lifted as the infantry advanced the famous creeping barrage. And the machine gun units advanced after the infantry had gone over and taken the trenches. They reached the Brown Line, one of the objectives, and they found it had been vacated by the enemy. And they made contact with the Canadians on their flank, who'd taken the village of Farbus. And then there was an officer called Lieutenant McNaughton. Battalion unit diary tells us he walked a considerable way down the Brown Line trench, but found it absolutely empty of either British or German troops. That's because either the Germans had been killed or captured or had evacuated their frontline trenches, and the British, of course, had moved on. On returning to his guns, he found our artillery were dropping shells into the Brown Line trench, and fearing he had advanced too far, he withdrew his subsection about 300 yards to the 2nd Brown Line trench. He says, during this time, 2nd Lieutenant Ridge had taken up positions with his subaltern at reference B19B39. 2nd Lieutenant Ridge and Sergeant Hind then went forward, presumably to recce, and were both sniped by the enemy and killed in Tommy Trench. Sergeant Hind had been killed in action, sniped. Except he hadn't. He wasn't killed. He was buried. His family told he was dead. But it was all wrong. It wasn't him. It was another sergeant. And who better to tell us the story than Sergeant Robert Hind himself? I found his story printed in the Sunday Post newspaper in February of 1919. And the article is written by the man himself. The headline says, "The Strange Case of Sergeant Robert Hind, Killed in Action, Buried by Comrades, and Back to Blighty After Being Mourned for Months." And it says that this was an exclusive article. Sergeant R.S. Hind, Machine Gun Corps, attached to the immortal 51st Division, who had just returned to his home in Dunfermline following his demob, relates the extraordinary story of how he came to be officially reported killed, how his comrades carried out his funeral and erected a cross over his grave. And of course the words funeral and grave are in inverted commas. And how in the end, after his parents had mourned his loss for 3 months, he returned to life. Again in inverted commas. And this is what Robert says. He says, "It's difficult to know where to start in writing the story of my death, in inverted commas, in No Man's Land on Vimy Ridge. And even now, I can scarcely realise that I am the central figure in such an amazing series of episodes." When he talks about being on Vimy Ridge, he wasn't actually. Rockland Claw is in the valley beneath the ridge, but that doesn't matter, does it? He says, "It was after serving nearly a couple of years in France with the 51st Division that these events took place. We were in the sector of the line north of Arras at Rockland Claw. I don't think I'll ever forget the date. It was the 9th of April 1917, and we were to go over the top at dawn. At 5:30 sharp, we left our positions, and so successful was our stunt that we had attained our objectives by midday, having advanced about a mile and a half. We were not too comfortable in our new positions, and it was decided to send out a reconnaissance party to look out for better places for the machine guns. Lieutenant Ridge, an officer from one of the other machine gun companies, and myself were selected for the job, and in the evening we crawled out. We'd been told that the German trenches were about 600 yards in front of us, and our intention was to pick out likely positions for machine guns so a more effective fire could be brought to bear on the enemy trenches. We crawled some little distance out, about 200 yards probably, when I spotted an old trench which appeared to be empty, and I pointed this out to Lieutenant Ridge and suggested that it would be a very suitable place for the guns. 'All right, Sergeant,' he whispered. You have a look in that trench. I crawled forward in front of him and jumped into the trench, and he followed a few yards behind. No sooner had I got in and looked around than I saw four Germans about 25 yards away, and as soon as they spotted us, they raised their rifles into a firing position. I immediately jumped back and took cover in a traverse, at the same time shouting to the officer, "We're in amongst the Germans." And he replied, "What shall we do, Sergeant?" "You're the senior. It's for you to say quick," I answered. "Let's fight for it," he exclaimed, and pulled out his revolver. I whipped out mine, and we fired a couple of shots, each in amongst them, so that they were afraid to pursue us. We commenced to retire in order to reach our own lines, but before we'd gone many yards, the officer was shot through the head and killed instantaneously. I crouched down behind his body, and no sooner had I done so than I received a heavy blow to the back from behind, which knocked me practically unconscious. Now, before we go any further, he talks about his officer there who wasn't sure what to do. Well, he was just 21 years old. And I found him. His name was Lieutenant Everard Vaughan Ridge. Died on the 9th of April 1917. His body's still out there somewhere. He's remembered on the Arras Memorial on Bay 10. So going back to Robert's story, he says, "The next thing I remembered, I was lying in a dugout in the German lines, and an officer was trying to interrogate me. He spoke English remarkably well, having, I learned, spent several years in England. Now," he said, "you are a prisoner. Do you realise your position?" "Yes," I replied. He asked me if it was the case that we were starving and that our people were living on black bread. I answered emphatically, "No, I've never tasted black bread in my life." He then wanted to know what was my profession in peacetime, and on learning that I was not a soldier, he grew angry and he exclaimed, "Yes, you're a cursed volunteer. You volunteered for this. Now you must suffer." He asked many other questions, to which I gave vague replies, sometimes merely saying, "I don't know." And after he'd finished, he signed to an escort and I was taken away to the rear of the lines. That night I walked about 20 kilometres and I was dead beat by evening time. But to reconstruct the story, I will here have to relate events of which I knew nothing till much later. Indeed, it was only after my release from Germany after the armistice that I discovered the whole facts of the case. In the meantime, though, I did not know it, but I'd been officially reported killed. And what is more, my death had been vouched for by an eyewitness who'd seen my dead body, in inverted commas, and had identified me. It sounds rather strange, but when all of the details of the story are brought to light, it seems simple enough. The next day, the dead body of my officer was found, and not far from him was discovered the remains of a sergeant of the machine gun corps. The sergeant had been shot in the forehead, and his face was splattered with blood. There were no letters or papers of any kind in his pockets. For being a big attack, all such papers are destroyed or sent back in case the owner is captured, and the papers disclose much valuable information. The identity disc of the sergeant had been obliterated a bit, but it was deciphered to a certain extent. It read, "Sergeant H. N. MGC, Machine Gun Corps." Meeting one or two of my chums since returning from Germany, I asked them to tell me how it came about that I'd been so emphatically declared to have been killed in action. They said when they discovered the body of the sergeant machine gunner, they were certain that it was I, even though the features were not too well recognisable owing to the wound and the blood. The only thing they could do in the circumstances, for it must be remembered that it was out in no man's land and in the bustle and chaos of the big action, where every man's whole energy and attention were fully occupied in consolidating positions and bringing up rations and ammunition, was to bury me in the nearest shell hole and put up a crude cross to mark the spot where I had fallen. Who the unknown sergeant was and how I learned that I'd been buried out in no man's land, I will narrate later, as it was in my prison camp in Germany that I pieced together that part of the story. My death was reported officially through the Red Records Office, and in due course the War Office sent the official notice home. That is the part of the business that I wish had never happened. Owing to the positive nature of the evidence regarding my death, my parents could hold out no hope whatsoever about my fate. Here was I in Germany, alive and well, at least as well as I could be in the circumstances, and my mother and father were mourning my loss, and their grief at the time will ever remain a bitter memory. Lieutenant McNaughton, one of my officers who took a great interest in me, wrote to my mother explaining how I'd been killed and sympathising with her in her sorrow. I would treasure these letters very much, and it's not everyone who has a chance of reading his own death notices. This is what he said in his letters. He said, "It is with much regret that I can tell you that I write to let you know the heavy news, which no doubt you already know, that your son was killed in action on April the 9th. My sympathies and my brother officers are all with you, and I wish to say how sincere and heartfelt they are. All who have known your boy loved him. Your sorrow is my sorrow." The letter goes on. He said, "We attacked at dawn on April the 9th, and your son fell sometime that afternoon or evening. Your son was a sergeant in my section, and I'd given him to my brother officer for the attack. They had two guns and apparently gone forward to recce the ground, for they did not return. You no doubt know that your boy was a corporal in No. 2 section until lately. I'd always liked him and admired his perseverance and pluck. When I had a vacancy, I promoted him over the heads of quite a number of non-commissioned officers in the company. He amply justified my trust in him, and never on any occasion did he fail me. I think of him as a personal friend and feel more deeply than you could perhaps imagine." And that same officer, McNaughton, he wrote another letter to Robert's sister, and that said, It is with deep regret that I have to return the letter you wrote to your brother on the 5th of April. As you're no doubt aware, he's been missing since the 9th. Indeed, now his death may have been taken as ascertained. A brother officer tells me he saw him dead, a wound through his head. He must have fallen at once, and I like to think he suffered no pain. We were all greatly attached to him, and as his officer, I miss him badly. Just imagine the grief of those people back home when they read this, as did hundreds of thousands of others. But he was missing. He'd been buried, so maybe they had some sort of closure. But all these people back home, whose relatives and loved ones had been reported as missing, they must have held out some hope, hope that never came. But in this case, it did, incredibly. The article goes on. Robert says, "My father and mother also received a letter from the Secretary of State for War expressing the true sympathy of His Majesty and the Queen in your sorrow. After mourning my death for 3 months, my father received a postcard from the Red Cross looking after prisoners of war in Germany. It was the effect that I was reported to be in such and such a camp. I will never forget the letter my father sent out to me immediately he received it. I destroyed the letter, but I can remember it well. He said he was overwhelmed with the news, but he did not like to place too much faith. If I were really alive, would I write at once? And if I'm not able to write, would I get someone to do it for me? One word only was necessary. Just write the one word, alive. That would fill the cup of joy and happiness to overflowing, as nothing else on this earth would do. Needless to say, I wrote as soon as I could, but it was a long time before they received it. I would have written much earlier, but we were strictly forbidden to do so. I tried to write, but my letters were destroyed. Even at that time, it was not certain to those at home that I was actually a prisoner of war in Germany. However, in the course of time, through the waiting must have been a trying period of suspense and worry to my father, mother and sister, I was able to assure them that their worst fears had not been realised, and in my case, that I was alive and well." He then goes on to talk about in the article about the awful experience he had as a prisoner of war. He said that one of the places he was sent to was Lille, a now beautifully rebuilt town in northern France near the Belgian border. He said, "I heard stories of the black hole of Lille, and from my experiences there I can only say whatever has been said about this frightful place errs, if anything, on the side of moderation. Along with over 100 others, I was shut up in a small dungeon for 13 days. I regarded 13 as an unlucky number, and after the terrible time I had in Lille, I'll always regard the number with horror. At the end of that time, I was so weak that I could hardly stand, and it was lucky for me that I was not kept there any longer, for I felt that if I remained there a day or two more, I would have gone under." He was then sent to various prisoners of war camps, but he then says, whilst he was in one of the camps, that he discovered how the mystery, the mistake had occurred. He says, "It was when I was in a prison camp at Gustrow, a that I learned about the remarkable incident which led to me being buried and reported killed in action. One day, another prisoner, also a machine gunner of the same division as my own, but in another company, stopped me. He said, "Excuse me, what is your name?" I told him. He said, "Well, you've been awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal." And I said, "No such luck. I'm more likely to get a district court-martial." But he replied, "I'm right, though. You went missing on the 9th of April, and you've been granted the Distinguished Conduct Medal just previously to that." "It couldn't be possible," I told him, "because I've been in fairly constant communication from home, and they haven't mentioned anything about it to me." "But you're in the 51st Division." "Yes. What brigade?" "The 153rd. "Ah," he said, "I must have made a mistake. The sergeant belonged to the 152nd. It was then that the truth dawned on me. The sergeant who had gone missing on the same day that I'd been killed was the man whose death my parents were mourning. And I, who had been buried in no man's land, was instead filling his role as a prisoner of war. The sergeant's name, I was certain, was Haynes, which would have accounted for the confusion of the identity discs. It was an extraordinary coincidence. The more I thought of it, the more I wondered how I became. Here I was, using another man's identity, when I should have been lying prone and cold beneath a rough little wooden cross in a shell hole. It was like reincarnation. In fact, when I look back on it, I always feel like shaking hands with him. Of course, I have no knowledge as to this, how this sergeant came to be alongside the officer who was killed. I can only assume that he must have been out on another recce party and strangely met his fate near the spot where we were. The signing of the armistice filled with feelings that I can scarcely describe. I was glad for the sake of the lads in the trenches, but uppermost in my mind, the thought of returning home and reassuring my father and mother by my presence that I'd pulled through practically unscathed. I'd like to have gone back through France to see my grave, but I never had the opportunity. Returning home via Denmark, the first thing I did was send a telegram to my mother, giving myself to you as a present. After I returned home, I met Lieutenant McNaughton in Edinburgh, and he was astounded to see me. He said he was absolutely convinced that I'd gone under as a brother officer of his, and he had seen my body. He told me that the division had left that part of the line a couple of days later, and that in the stress of battle, it was quite conceivable Harris' mistake in identity might have been made. So great news for Robert Hind and his family, and he went on to achieve much in his life. He went on to medical school. But what happened to him eventually is a mystery, because I've searched the archives on Ancestry and Find My Pass, and I don't know what happened to him in the end. I don't know when he died. But we do know he didn't die on the 9th of April 1917. But where one's family's joy, there must be another family that ended up heartbroken. Who was that sergeant in the machine gun corps that was buried instead in that shell hole in Tommy's Trench near Rocklin Corps? I thought I was going to be able to identify him, because in Robert's account, he said that he'd found out the main man's name was Haynes. And in the article, he'd spelt it H-A-I-N-E-S. But you can also spell Haynes, H-A-Y-N-E-S. And I've searched the archives of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. There are one or two candidates that partially meet the criteria, but none of them are sergeants. None of them were awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal. And of those that do partially meet the criteria, unfortunately, none of them are called Haynes with either spelling. At the moment, the identity of that man whose body was mistaken for Robert Hind will remain one of the Great War's mysteries. But if you're listening to this and your research skills are better than mine, or fresh eyes sometimes help, then please see what you can do. See if you can find out who that man was. And does he have a grave now? Or is he remembered like so many others on the Arras Memorial to the Missing? And our final stop in this week's podcast, another recording that I made on the battlefields itself, was a cemetery on the outskirts of Arras called Achincourt. Achincourt Road Cemetery, that's spelled A-C-H-I-C-O-U-R-T. A cemetery hidden away behind some houses. These are my thoughts when I visited that cemetery a couple of weeks ago. Just 2 kilometres south of Arras, there's a grass path with a very high hedge on one side and someone's back garden on the right. And then really, this cemetery is tucked away in amongst a load of houses, the back garden of people's houses. This cemetery was begun in March 1917 and only used for 4 months. The graves from those 4 months are in rows A to C. The majority are officers and men of the London Regiment. And then they used the cemetery again in August and September 1918. And in row E, there's a lot of Canadians. There's just 131 burials here. Only 8 are unidentified. 76 of them are the identified casualties are from the UK and 47 from Canada. And then if we go to row C, plot 11, and we're going to look for James Mayers. Very unusual cemetery. It just feels like you are in someone's back garden, doesn't it? Yep, Susan's found James Mayers, and looks like James has had a visitor because someone has put a cross in front of it with a poppy on, British Legion cross. No family inscription. And we've got Private 492050 James Mayers from the Kensington Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, executed for desertion on the 16th of June 1917. One of the replacements for the Somme casualties from that regiment, he was already subjected to a suspended sentence for quitting his post when, after a rather trying tour in the trenches, he deserted and was found in a village. So the key here to this is not the fact he's deserted, it's the fact that it is a repeat offender. And obviously it's gone all the way up to Hague, and Hague has decided that as a repeat offender, he needs to be made an example of. And again, this is 1917, you know, things are going badly. We've got Passchendaele, Third Battle of Ypres is planned. Arras battle has gone badly, and the Germans Russians are about to capitulate, and most importantly, the French have mutinied in this area just south of here, and they're really worried that this is going to happen. Someone, you know, they've got to make it clear that desertion and mutiny will not be tolerated. And I also noticed just over there, look, there's a private Arthur Garfield Swalls from the Canadian Machine Gun Corps, 23rd of August 1918. Family inscription says, "I gave my body to the earth, my soul to God, and my heart to humanity." But there's something missing from that headstone that's on all
there's
the
no
others.
Cross.
There's no cross. Now, sometimes people remove the cross from the form they were sent because they've lost their faith because of the death. But they clearly haven't.
No, because
the personal
to God.
Inscription refers to God, but there's no cross there. So it's another question with no answer. The man we've come to see, serving with the London Regiment, is in row B. Headstone tells us, serving with the London Scottish, died just before the Battle of Arras began on the 5th of April 1917 at the age of 26. He was a Lance Corporal, and the parents have chosen beautiful words for his family inscription. He is a portion of the loveliness which once he made more lovely. And they've got a photograph of him there, look. Before he's gone into uniform. The sad news is received that Lance Corporal C.F. Tolliday was killed in action on the 5th of April in his 25th year. It will cause deep sorrow in Northampton, that he was a young man of high character and attainments whose death is a great loss to the musical life of the town. He was a musician. His home was at 64 Abington Avenue, Northampton, and he was trained for the teaching profession
for which he was already specially qualified by his many graces of heart and mind. He became assistant manager at the Stimpson Avenue School, which is still there,
okay,
in Stimpson Avenue, strangely enough. And he graduated Bachelor of Arts at London University. He was a valued member of the St Matthew's Choir, which is a church still there,
mm-hmm,
and the late choir master at St Sculpture's Church, which the locals call Stets. Gifted with a fine baritone voice, he was ever ready to give his aid at concerts for good causes, in conjunction with his only sister, Maud, who was the pianist and is an assistant at St Giles School. He was her only brother, so there was naturally a deep devotion between them. The severance of such a tie will arouse the deepest sympathy with the young lady in the heavy blow she has to suffer. The sadness of his death is deepened by the fact that his colonel had just signed his papers for a commission in the Royal Artillery.
So that's it for this week. When I started the podcast over 4 years ago now, my idea was that I would try and tell stories that had never been told before, and I'm pretty sure that all of the stories I've told this week have not been told before, because I found all of them within the newspaper archives, not in books or on documentaries or anywhere else. Stories of soldiers and their relatives, like Helen McKee, that had perhaps been forgotten about, and that extraordinary story of meeting Adolf Hitler in the early 1930s. It's exactly the sort of thing I wanted to talk about and hoped that people would listen to me. And I'm delighted to see that so many people do listen to me, and it's also a great experience for me when I'm out on the battlefields and I meet people that listen to the podcast. It's happened several times recently on the Somme when people have come up and said, "Oh, you're Terry," and introduce themselves. It's a great feeling to know that I'm not just talking to myself. So all it remains for me to do is to say thank you once again for tuning in to the podcast. We'll be back again next week. Don't know what we'll be talking about, but I'll think of something. I'm off to Normandy now on another battlefield tour, and we're going to end, I think it's appropriate that we sound the last post in memory of all of the soldiers that we talked about today that fought and died in the Battle of Arras in April of 1917.